and this is the Conference on World Affairs Session 5203, What I Learned from Remarkable People. My name is Rita Cleese. I'll be the moderator of this session. I'm an environmental engineer and alumni of CU's College of Engineering. I had a 20-year career in international development, and now I'm back at CU as a scholar in residence teaching global engineering and development. So I'm delighted to moderate this session today. I've heard most of the speakers at other panels this week, and I found them to be remarkable themselves. And today they'll be talking about lessons they learned from remarkable people. The format is for each of our three speakers to present remarks on the topic for 5 to 10 minutes. Then they're free, as they choose, to respond to one another for a few minutes. Then we go to the Q&A. So I assume many people have been here all week, but for new people, this year we're using both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from you. To ask a question in the app, you select the session in the schedule, tap Q&A, and insert and send your question. You can also raise your hand. We have 2 producers. Want to raise your hands, producers?
The other
one's outside. If you raise your hand, they'll bring you a note card and then pick up the question when you're done. If you're a student, please make that very evident. Students get first call on the questions. So let me introduce our panelists today. To my left is Andy Larrett. The biographies of all these people are in the program, so I'm not going to go over them. I'll just say a few sentences so you know where they're placed today and where they're working. Andy's the senior editor on the NBC News Investigations team and director of investigative reporting at the City University of New York. He's won numerous awards. You can read about those in the bio in the program. Next to Andrew is Ann Reynolds. Ann began her career at ABC in the 1980s as a producer and director of Good Morning America. She's held multiple positions with ABC since then and continues to be there, and where she's senior producer for ABC News specialized units. She's won 4 Emmys and a host of other awards. Tyler Weinberg is a multidisciplinary artist and educator. Her work is held in public and private collections and is exhibited internationally. She is currently the recipient of a 3-year Tulsa Artist Fellowship and is teaching at the University of Tulsa. So with that, I'll turn it over to our panelists.
You first.
It should be ladies first.
I think it's person next to the moderator.
There you go. Okay. Good morning. Thank you all for being here. And sorry we're not the Simpsons, or at least I'm not. But you can laugh at me nonetheless. You were telling a great story before all of this began. You were telling us about when Jane Goodall was here. And she said, you know, how does a turtle get to a flagpole? It doesn't get there by itself.
The top of the flagpole.
Top of the flagpole, right. One of the things that I always worry about, that people think like, oh, there's just one person, or, you know, there's one lightning bolt moment that, you know, helps you become who you are. And I know that's not the case for me. And if she's not here right now, but if there was one person who is so responsible for helping me so much, it would be my wife. And I think sometimes people think, oh, it's going to be some professional person, but she would be the first person I would mention who's encouraged me, stood by me, been with me. My kids, too. I learn a lot from my kids all the time. I mean, people think like, oh, it's the dad teaching the kids. We learn so much from our kids. My parents were immigrants, and you know, from them I learned so much about the idea that the one thing no one can ever take away from you is an education. And so I strongly, you know, believe in getting an education. It's the one thing we value a lot. And my friends, of course, who've stood by me for so long. But you probably all don't want to hear that, but I just want to say, like, this is all there. But you're probably thinking like, oh, he's a journalist, so how do you get to be a journalist? And as a teenager, yeah, it was Woodward and Bernstein. You know, when you're a teenage kid and you see all the President's Men, or you're watching Watergate unfolding, and you're thinking, you know, you're realizing it's a lot of work, it's difficult, but it can be important. That is inspirational. And I think there are a lot of us from our generation that drew inspiration from the work of Woodward and Bernstein and Cy Hirsch and journalists like that. You know, it meant a great deal. As an only child as well, you know, you go beyond just the people in your profession. I remember, you know, artists, writers, musicians, you know, as an only child, you know, sometimes wondering where the world could take me. Growing up in a, you know, in a poor part of Miami, Florida, you know, I would find myself, you know, where would my imagination take me? I'd find myself listening a lot to Bruce Springsteen. So I was imagining one day, maybe I'll get to New Jersey. It's where I live now.
Goals.
You know, but there are many other great journalists I've gotten to work with along the way. Diana Enriquez at the New York Times, John Larson, an amazing correspondent at NBC. But there's a couple people I want to talk about right now in particular. One is Brant Houston. It's a journalist whose name you probably don't know at all. But he's probably had more influence on the current generation of investigative journalists, not only in America, but around the world. Who is he? He was the executive director of Investigative Reporters and Editors, a nonprofit based in Missouri that is the journalism nonprofit that teaches journalists how to do investigative work. It's not a schmooze fest. It's where we actually discuss our craft. And we share ideas. So if you think you're at the Washington Post, you're not going to share ideas with the guys from the New York Times, let alone the LA Times, let alone the networks. No. This is where we all go to share our ideas. And we're open about it. It's where we learn. IRE was a small organization when Brant took it over. And by the time he was done with it, it's become a gigantic operation that runs amazing conferences. How do I know Brant? My very first introduction to IRE was a friend of mine who was at the Hartford Courant said, there's going to be this regional IRE conference. Do you want to go up, come up, and you can crash on my floor? As a reporter at a small paper in Philadelphia, I made the trip up there. And Brant was the guy who organized that conference while he was at the Hartford Courant. A couple years later, I find myself thinking, like, I want to actually go work for IRE. I think I've learned a lot stepping outside my newspaper, working for him. He created a fellowship for me to be employed and get my master's degree at IRE. I worked for him. He was a tough boss. He was a great boss. The thing about Brant is he'll tell you, you know, working for him is like the Hotel California. You can check out. You can never leave. Brant moved on, and he's one of the things that he's done is he's created a global version of IRE. It's called the Global Investigative Journalism Network. And we essentially now go and travel the world and try to teach our craft to journalists around the world. I've been to Ukraine. I've been to Egypt. I've been to Nepal. I've been to South Korea, South Africa. Wherever journalists think that we can come and help teach our craft to them, even if they're in repressive regimes, we can teach them to maybe push the envelope a little bit more. When Brant calls, my answer is always yes. So anyway, I can't say enough about his work and the influence he's had on journalists. One last story.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So Brant is truly amazing. One other person, by the way, who's meant a great deal for me is I have a perverse hobby, although I understand it's kind of common around here. I like to run marathons. And I never thought I would do it. I'm an accidental marathoner. I was just running with a friend regularly. He wanted to run a marathon, and one day I looked up and I realized, oh my God, I run so much I could probably jump in one. I did one. It was tough, and I just found like I want to try another one. At a certain point, I'd run like five or six. I'd gotten to run Boston. It was amazing. But I was thinking like, okay, I think I've kind of done this. I'm not sure if I want to do it anymore. But I kept seeing these athletes who were disabled, and they were running with guides. And I was just so moved by seeing that work. And so one day, if you've ever been to a marathon, to get your number that you wear on your chest, you have to run a gauntlet through an expo where they try to sell you all the crap you never need. You can't get your number otherwise. But there, at the end of that gauntlet, was a lone booth run by a nonprofit organization called Achilles International. And I went up to them and I said, "So to run with a disabled athlete, you have to run with them for months, right?" And they said, "No, you can actually run with them on race day." And I was like, "Well, with my work schedule, I could do that. How do I do this?" "Well, you need to apply." "How do I apply?" "It's a lot like applying for college. I got to write an essay, and I got to submit my test scores, in this case, my running times." They paired me up with a Norwegian blind mother of two who lives off of in a tiny village off of Fjord in Norway. She works full-time as a mother of two, and we start exchanging emails, and I'm just like, "Oh my God, this person's amazing," and we just totally connect. She's coming to run the New York City Marathon, and this will be fantastic, except for one thing: Hurricane Sandy hits. And the mayor didn't cancel the marathon right away. So she's calling me from Norway. We've still never met, but we're exchanging emails furiously all summer into the fall. "Should I come? I've used my savings. This is everything to me. This is a dream. But do I get on that plane and spend that money?" It's like, "I don't know what to tell you. The mayor says the race is still on." She flies, comes to New York. I'm due to meet her Friday evening. 15 minutes before I meet her, the mayor cancels the race. I meet her, and she's a pool of tears. We're consoling her for an hour, and finally, you know, she knows I work at the New York Times, and ask her, "So, do you want to say anything?" She gives us a beautiful quote. It's on the front page of the next day's paper. But I'm talking to her some more, and I realize, wait a minute, she's not only losing the chance to run New York, she's losing 6 months of training with guides in Norway. You know, and in Norway, they don't have many marathons in the winter. But there's a lot in America. And I said, "If I could get you in another marathon somewhere on the East Coast." She's like, "Could you?" I got her the very last slot of a tiny marathon in the Poconos in Pennsylvania. The very last slot. When I registered her, I couldn't then register her Norwegian guide nor myself. I'm tracking her down the race director at like 11 o'clock Friday night. I said, "You got a blind Norwegian runner set to run Sunday. But her guides can't get in. Don't worry. You guys are good." So we go and run New York, and the editors hear what I did. And we go and run the Poconos. We had an amazing, wonderful race. The editors hear what I did, and the editors say, you got to write it up." And it's like, I don't like mixing personal with professional. "You got to write it up." So I wrote it up, and they said something you never hear in journalism: "Make it longer." So I make it longer, and we write the story, it publishes, it goes viral. Alina then gets interviewed by all sorts of Norwegian media, and these businesses then say, "Yeah, we'll sponsor you to go back to New York." So we go and run New York the following year, and we have a great race. She qualifies for Boston. And we're like, okay, so I'm handling all her paperwork to run Boston. And at one point, the race director there says, "Well, you know she's not going to win." And I'm like, "We're just trying to register her." So we go and run Boston, and it's miserable. It's awful. It's less than 40 degrees. It's windy, cold, rainy, lips turning blue. We run the race. There's all kinds of difficulties. And at the end of the race, we're sitting in a parking lot where we're trying to collect some belongings she left at the starting line from another disabled running group. And the running group says, "We'll be there in a few minutes. By the way, Alina, we have good news for you. You finished in third place." That's awesome. So we're sitting there waiting in the parking lot. I pull up my phone and I'm paging through, and I turned to her and I said, "Alina, I got bad news for you. You didn't finish in third. You finished in first." She's an inspiration. I can't tell you. You know, there's so many days I think like, oh, this is a hard day. You know, seeing what she does with her life and the inspiration I draw from her just means so much. So anyway, with that, I will pass the mic.
Okay, can I simply let an Andy be remarkable person? Okay. My first lesson, I've got sort of what they taught me after this. My first comment is Audrey Hepburn. Mm-hmm. I interviewed Audrey Hepburn. She was doing work for UNICEF, and so she appears, and she always wore Givenchy. So she's in this perfect sort of periwinkle blue little Givenchy shift dress with matching shoes in exactly the same color. And we're doing okay lights, okay. Everybody's phone's off, okay. Everybody ready? Miss Hepburn, are you ready? And she leaned forward and put her hand on my knee and said, "Anne, do I look all right?" The lesson I learned from this is everyone is insecure. When Audrey Hepburn is asking me if she looks all right. My next is my son, Ashby. He was a very little guy at the time. He was in preschool. We lived down the street from the preschool. I am having a bad morning where everything's disorganized. I have an older daughter. I have a younger daughter. I'm running around. I haven't brushed my hair. And he said, "Mommy, we have to go. We're going to be late." And I said, "I know, sweetheart, we're not going to be that late. It's okay." This I attribute to my husband, who's a punctuality freak. And he's like pacing up and down this morning saying, "We're going to be late." And I'm like, "Yeah, to preschool." So now Ashby's saying, "Mommy, we're going to be late." And I'm like, "Honey, I have to brush my hair." And he said, "Okay, but we don't want to be late." So we toddle down the street after I brush my hair. And he, on the way, is saying, "Today we're going to the aquarium." And so I go to the front of the preschool, and the door's locked. There's a second entrance. So we go to the second entrance, and the door's locked. And I slowly realize that they have left for the aquarium because we're 10 minutes late. And so I had to say to my 3-year-old guy, I think he was almost 4, "I'm sorry, sweetheart. I think we were too late and we missed the bus." And he lost it, you know, just dissolved in tears. And we were on one of those brownstone stoops in New York, and he just, boom, sat down, and he was crying. And I said, "Sweetheart, you can be angry at Mommy, because this was my fault. I had to brush my hair, which was not important, and you told me we had to be on time, and that's my fault, and I'm very sorry." And he looked up at me and said, "It's okay, Mommy. It was an honest mistake." He taught me forgiveness. I'm sorry, I still get crazy on that one. Bad mom tattooed on the forehead. The next one is Diane Sawyer, who I am lucky enough to work with. First of all, she really is that good. She's smarter than most people I know. She's a better producer than most people I know, and she's on camera. She's also, aside from all those lessons that you learn with working with somebody, she is one of the most considerate and consistently kind person I've ever met. She thanks everybody on the crew. We had to do a stand-up in Times Square. Complicated jib shot, all this equipment. And there was a construction project a half a block away with bam, 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 and I'm thinking, how am I dealing with this? So this is a producer's job. I ran over to the base of this construction thing, and I was, "Guys," I said, "Diane Sawyer, I'm rolling. Can you be quiet?" And they all like looked at each other and said, "Yeah, okay." So they're all hanging out, you know, on the side watching me, you know, half a block away, and they can't hear what Diane's saying. But we do like 3 takes of the voiceover. It's fine. And I'm then talking to the crew, and she walks over half a block and says, "Thank you, guys!" And they're all waving at her, and I'm thinking, who do I know who's a correspondent who would do that? She also writes thank you notes. I've worked with her for 20 years. She has never expressed impatience or anger with me. And I know I have deserved it because television's messy. And I have failed to get something somewhere on time. Never a word. So from her, I learned graciousness and to be thankful for people's effort. And my last one is my mom, who is such an extraordinary person. My mom is from the north of England. And she decided she wanted to be a doctor. So she went to the head of the medical school and made an appointment with the dean and went in and said, I'd like to go to medical school now. And he said, you're 14. We don't take 14-year-olds. And she said, when will you take me? And he said, I think just spitballing. He said, well, if you're still interested on your 16th birthday, come back. On her 16th birthday, she was back with all of her grades, all of this. And he let her in. One of two women in her class, because women weren't doctors in the mid-40s. She graduated from medical school. She wanted to be a surgeon. They said, we can't stop you from training for surgery, but we'll tell you that no patients will let you operate on them and no nurses will scrub for you. So she became an anesthesiologist because she was still in the OR. So she graduated from medical school. She was 21. And she, we had relatives apparently in Johannesburg in South Africa. So she said, well, I'll go visit some relatives, have a little trip. So she went there for 3 weeks, and it was a lot of British expats having tea parties and nice dances. And after 3 weeks, she was like, well, this is great, but I haven't seen Africa at all. So my mother hitchhiked around Africa alone for 9 months. That was fascinating. And I'd stay with someone, and they'd write me a letter for the next little town, and I'd go to the town and I'd say, hi, you know, this person wrote a letter, and they'd say, come on in. And so then she moved to Los Angeles through a bunch of little, mostly because she was from Newcastle upon Tyne, and I don't know if you've been to Newcastle upon Tyne, but it's a great place to be from. And she basically swore, as God is my witness, I'm going to live somewhere warm that has decent plumbing. And she ended up in Los Angeles, met my father. My father was the only person she knew at her wedding. Because people don't come from Newcastle upon Tyne to Los Angeles to go to somebody's wedding. She then was a practicing anesthesiologist, married to another doctor. She had two kids, my brother and me. She kept working the whole time. Anesthesiologists have to be in surgery. Surgery often happens in the morning, so she was always at the hospital at 6 a.m. So she would put on extra lipstick in the morning and come in and kiss each of us on our forehead. So when we woke up, we'd run to the mirror to see if Mommy had said good morning. She also was the den mother for the Cub Scouts. I thought I was a Cub Scout because I had a kerchief, because John had a kerchief. And I later said, you know, Mommy, gosh, you did so many wonderful things, and you were the den mother of the Cub Scouts. And she said, you bet I was. I'm sorry, I'll do her accent. You bet I was. An organization where men like to put on shorts and little uniforms and be around small boys. I was going to be right there standing next to her. She was also a group leader for the Campfire Girls. That was my organization. And all the other groups of Campfire Girls were doing embroidery and learning how to serve tea. And my mother was doing woodwork and car mechanics. We were nine, but she said, you know, the gasoline goes in here and there are pistons here and you guys got to learn. There's something called changing a tire. Let me show you what you need. My mother, the feminist campfire mother, she taught me how to balance work and life, that work is life. And I'm a television producer with three kids. And let me tell you, television producing is much like medicine. It doesn't happen so early in the morning, unless you're working for Good Morning America, in which case. But I didn't work for Good Morning America all the time. But so my mother taught me to be indomitable.
you want something, you do it. She always said to me, well, there's always a way, dear. So when I would call her and I'd say, I don't know, I'm stuck in this associate producer job. It seems like there's the Grand Canyon between associate producing and producing, and I don't know how to leap a call. And she'd say, well, there's always a way, dear. And whenever I was impatient about anything, she would say, Anne Elizabeth Reynolds, I didn't raise you to give up. That's my list.
Give me the mic before
Two mics, they're next to each person.
Before Tali starts, let me just remind you, if you have a question, now would be a good time to raise your hand, and the producer will get the card from you, and we'll get into those after we hear from our final speaker.
Good morning, everybody. So, excuse me first, I'm still a little teary from some of the earlier stories. I'm going to take a slightly different tack, being the artist on the panel. I'm going to start by explaining, you know, some of the overarching questions that guide my practice, because the part of the title that I was really drawn to was the what I've learned, so learning and knowledge, which is something I'm interested in. So there are these two intertwining sets of questions. The first is, what do we think knowledge is, or what kind of knowledge do we value? So who are the voices that we listen to? Where do we think it comes from? And then the second question is, how do we experience and respond to systemic traumas, like climate change, like gender violence? And so from there, how do these questions relate? Well, how does our understanding of what knowledge is and our and the kind of knowledge we value shape the way that we respond to or perpetuate a systemic trauma like climate change? So for me, it's a lot about where we're learning or what we think learning is. And so I want to talk to you about not so much people, though there are many, many incredible people who have helped to shape my way of thinking, but I'm going to talk a little bit about my my material practice. So first, I've been working with climate data for the last 4 years, and that work with data, my newest interest is in the material origins of this data. So when I started working with it, I was thinking about all of the people, the labor and the time and the knowledge across scientific disciplines that had gone into making something that we can then digest really quickly and understand something very complicated very quickly. But actually where all of that data is coming from is from tree rings, from ice cores, from bee pollen, these other beings in the world. And that those material origins are also obscured, not just the time and the labor. And in thinking about climate change, these same beings are our sources of knowledge about the environment or about climate or about human impact on climate, we're destroying them. So, you know, bees and trees, forest fires and species loss. So I think, you know, it's important to sort of go all the way back. How are we really related? Where are we learning from? And then the other thing I want to talk about is weaving. So I've been weaving this climate data. I've been weaving for about 10 years, and I've learned a lot from that process. And one of the key things for me is I think of weaving as a language, and it's a language that allows me to speak beyond binaries, because I feel like we often get caught up in something is this or that, something is bad or good, something is just or unjust, something is nature or culture, and weaving is simultaneously, say, creative, but also mathematical and structural thinking. It's intimate, cloth is intimate, it's something that's in our homes and on our bodies, And it's also this very key part of the history of global trade. It's domestic. It's something that we associate as women's work. But it's also industrial. It fueled the production of cloth, fueled the Industrial Revolution. It's attached to this history of injustice. So the Industrial Revolution, all of labor exploitation, and also that being a really key moment when it comes to anthropogenic climate change, the production of cotton and slavery in the United States, and at the same time, learning about the history of textiles and weaving, it's also a point of resistance and a point of social change. So the women laborers who are responsible for some of the unions and labor rights that we have now, or hopefully will continue to have, or Gandhi's use of cloth to try to fight British colonialism. It's art and it's science, and it's also a language, and it's got a history as a language, a subversive language for women. So the one other thing I'll talk about is weaving as being relational. So as an artist, and particularly as an artist thinking work about climate change or other social justice issues, there's a lot of discussion about representation. And one of the things that I've learned from weaving, or that I continue to learn from weaving, is how I'm situated in the world. And all of the other people and things that I rely on in order to make my work. Because we think of artists as solitary in their studios, but actually, in order to make my work, there's the knowledge of the scientists who have produced the data that I'm working with. There's the activists who are on the front lines, protecting our land and our water and our air. And I learn a lot from their actions. And their perspectives. There's the ecologists. There's the people who cultivate the materials that I work with. So the woman who grows the cotton that I use to weave, who's been reviving heirloom cotton, so color-grown cotton. Who knew that before the Industrial Revolution, cotton wasn't just white. And then the activity of all of these other living things. So in order to make my work, in order to weave, in order to dye my materials, I use plant and insect derived dyes. The ecosystem has to be healthy. It matters what's in the water, it matters what's in the air, it matters what's in the soil. So a little bit different than the personal stories, but this art practice has, in a lot of ways, taught me to be in the world a little bit differently than I had talked to you before.
Thank you, Kelly. Again, just raise your hand if you'd like to write down a question. And before we launch into Q&A, would the panelists like to respond to anything that you've heard here?
I don't think it was mentioned, but you can go see Tali's work at the Art Museum, right next door. I actually had not met her, but I had wandered over to the museum for a break and had seen her work as part of the exhibit that's going on in the museum. And then we happened to have gotten a ride afterwards, and we were talking about what we do, and she mentioned us, like, I just saw your work in the museum. And she was kind enough to invite us to go visit her working with the graduate students up in the lab. It was very incredible.
Okay, anybody else? Okay, Tali, I'm going to pass this question down to you to take a look at while I just make one comment while we launch into some questions. I'm just giving Tali one of the questions because I can't read the handwriting, so I do see it's addressed to her, so please make sure you're writing very clearly. And I just wanted to finish the story I told Andrew to get it right in honor of Jane Goodall, who certainly is a remarkable person to me. When I encourage all of you to reflect on this question to yourself in your own life, which I did when I knew I was going to be moderating the panel. The first thing that came to my mind was a recollection that has stuck with me. When I was at a lecture given by Jane Goodall several years ago, long 10-minute introduction, and even then they weren't, you know, hitting on all her honors and awards and all that she's accomplished. A terrific introduction. Jane walks out. She seems to be a very modest woman. Takes the stage and says, "If you see a turtle on top of a flagpole, you know it didn't get there by itself." You should be doing this again with your British accent. And then she said, "I'm that turtle, and it's my mother who got me here." And went on to spend the first 10 minutes of what people were expecting to be a technical talk, talking about all that her mother, who I believe was still living at the time, had done for her, and how much I remember that, and my own mother who's still alive. So that was a Jane story. And before we get to the questions, I just want to do a reality check for Andrew. This is Boulder. Andrew, I just thought I'd ask, how many people here have run a marathon? Run a marathon. Okay, jeez. Just saying, that's a lot of you.
They can
you're
relate.
Welcome here. Please come back. Okay, would you like to answer?
Yeah, and I apologize, first of all, I can't read all of it, but the part I can read I do want to magnify. It's saying that when talking about knowledge and history, I hope I'm reading this correctly, that it's important to point out the values of Native Americans. Yes. I didn't go into any specifics, but Weaving has an indigenous history, it's indigenous knowledge when talking about the lands and what we understand about the land and relationality. Absolutely, the indigenous perspective and experience and learning that has been incredibly important. And I'll say, I moved to Oklahoma from California at the beginning of 2017. So I spent most of my adult life between New York and California and had a pretty traditional educational upbringing, which also meant that I didn't know a lot about Native American history or settler colonialism in the United States, or that there was still such such a rich culture and population. Oklahoma has a very large Native population, in part because it's the end of the Trail of Tears. Understanding settler colonialism, understanding the ways in which that way of thinking and being in the world has been so destructive has been a really important part of my practice also. So thank you to whoever wanted to highlight that.
And when I mentioned the other day, you actually brought that up during that conversation. So.
Okay, should we get to the questions then?
Sure.
Okay, so first question is from a student. A student says, "All members of the panel seem like remarkable people to me. How can one contribute remarkably to the world without or outside of a professional career?"
That one seems really easy to me because the things I learned from remarkable people are so ordinary. As I recall, "We're All Insecure" from Audrey Hepburn. "Be Kind" from my little boy. "Be Gracious and Thank People" from Diane. And "Be Indomitable" from Mom, "There's Always a Way." That isn't big scale stuff. But if you drop a pebble in a pond, the ripples go out. If you try to be all these things, that will have an effect on everything around you, and it'll have effect on you. It's easier in your life if you thank people because they like you more. And that, you know, really affects things. It's easier if you realize we're all insecure, because then when someone is acting like an asshole, you can think, you know, I think this is coming from a place of insecurity, so I can kind of
you know, feel a little more empathetic rather than just wanting to throw them out a window. If you can be kind to people, that makes them feel better, which is just kind of a good thing. And it might mean that they pass it forward and they're kind to other people. It's really ordinary lessons that have an effect on you and your little ecosystem.
Hey, anybody else?
Listen and care. Attention. I think no matter what you're doing, care for the people and the things around you.
Okay. So the next question from a student. What is the best lesson learned that has helped you in your career? Who did you learn it from?
I need a moment to think.
Yeah. Oh, yes, it's always Anna who starts talking. I think it was accidental. I had absolutely no training in television news. I mean, it wasn't anything I was supposed to do. I was pre-med. Go figure. As I say, there was this Grand Canyon between associate producing and producing, and I moved to another show, and I was an associate producer. And I had my list of, you know, story ideas because I was trying to, you know, help out. And my executive producer, who was sort of a gruff person, looked at the list, and he said, yeah, no, we've done that. No, yeah, no. Number six. You can do number six. And I said, sure. Thinking, okay, I'll go find the producer and set it up for them. And he said, when can you shoot it? And I said, well, I'll check with the subject and see, probably this week or next week. He said, great. Don't make it longer than about 6 minutes, all right? And I thought, oh, damn, I'm supposed to produce it. I've never done this. And it... So I called a person who had just worked on the previous show, and I said, I need a really quick lesson in producing. So we went out to lunch, and he said, okay, what's the story? And I said, well, it's this tiny little town on Long Island, you know, beaver cleaver, white, truly white picket fences, and in one of those little houses is a family that blows things up for a living. And he said, write that down. And I said, why? And he said, that's the first sentence of your piece. And I thought, oh, just tell the story. Oh, I get it now. And you show up and you get a camera person and a sound person and you say, you know, it would be, you can get a shot of the audience wide, but then you don't, if you like put the water bottle in the front and then you kind of squunch down and you kind of could see it like this, and the camera person would say, yeah, okay. And I thought, oh, you just tell them what you want. And with the sound person, you just say, I want to hear it. That one's easy. And then you go into the edit room, and you say, I think the most interesting thing is this little thing, so could we put that first? And they say, yeah, sure. And I think, oh, you just tell them. This all happened because the executive producer just told me to do it. With no, didn't ask me if I could do it, didn't. And at the end of that piece, I was a producer. And that's all I've done ever since, is, you know, what's the story? What's the most interesting way to start it? What shots do you want? Do you want sound? Yes, you want to hear it. Get to the editor, help them put it together, say, that doesn't really work, can you start with this? And that was all because I was kind of forced to learn it.
So the lesson that I learned, and I learned it from several people, is I had several bosses that said, essentially, you figure it out. These were bosses who afforded me great space and latitude to try to come up with my own stories. They trusted us to come up with our own stories. Not every boss is like that, especially in journalism. I was fortunate at a very small newspaper in Philadelphia to have bosses that just said, three stories a week, your call.
Wow.
Figure it out. And since I was interested in doing investigative reporting, my very first investigative stories were there, because every month I would try to get one small story, one small investigative story. From there, I built up skills that I learned. So to Del Ponce and Don Kappa, I am forever grateful for that. My bosses since then, Brian Houston, who I mentioned, same thing. he gave me a lot of space. My boss is currently at NBC. Same thing. My boss is at the New York Times. Same thing. So giving that, and by the way, I pass that forward. I teach an investigative reporting class at the City University of New York. It's a third semester class. They're expected to be relatively skilled by the time they get to my classroom. They all do their own stories. I'm not the professor who tells them they're going to go investigate something. They have to pitch to me. And they spend the first 6 weeks pitching dozens of ideas to me. Most of the time I say no, but when we find a good one, we find a good one. But there's also things that I've, if I may indulge in one more. Okay? I also learned, to give you an idea of like how we go about doing our craft, I want to tell you about how we go about learning from people we've never even met. So, I'm at NBC News. It's before I went to the New York Times. I was doing long-form documentaries, essentially. And there had been a shooting in Cincinnati. And the person I'm about to learn from is a young black male named Timothy Thomas. He was shot by the Cincinnati police in 2001. And when he was shot, his death, he was unarmed. His death caused riots in the city of Cincinnati. And those riots were covered by news organizations all around the world. Front pages of all the newspapers, leading evening newscasts. My boss at the time at NBC is a wonderful man who, again, gave us a lot of free space. His name is Neil Shapiro. Neil called me in and another producer in, and Neil said, go and find a story that everyone else is missing. Spent a lot of time thinking about Timothy Thomas. And one of the things I do, and I want to explain a little bit about how we do investigative reporting. So what are people missing? Okay, Timothy Thomas was shot by police. What do I know about this? I know whatever everyone else knows, but let's slow it down. How do I know he was shot? Okay, I'm going to go and get the footage from the cop car from when he was shot. What did the cop know? The cop basically didn't recognize Timothy at all. He heard over the staccato radio, 14 outstanding warrants left for a tall black male, Timothy Thomas, 19, appears in this part of dodgy part of Cincinnati over the Rhine. Be on the lookout for him. The officer sees Timothy Thomas, chases him down an alley and thinks that Timothy is going for a gun. There was no gun ever on him. The cop is scared, probably, maybe, I don't know, but the cop shoots and kills him. So I'm playing this forward and I start thinking like, okay, this is how we do our stories. Okay, 19 years old, 14 outstanding warrants. What's everyone thinking? What's the cop thinking? You know, how does our criminal justice system work, right? You're a juvie until you're 18, so if you're a badass, you have a clean record when you turn 18. Timothy Thomas had to have amassed his 14 outstanding warrants from 18 to 18 months or so later. So the cop's thinking I'm chasing a badass around midnight on Saturday in a bad part of town. So I'm thinking like, okay, well, where are those 14 outstanding warrants from? Everyone else is covering the riots and the upset. I go to the courthouse, and I pull out the warrants, and they all stem from traffic tickets.
Oh, jeez.
He was not a drug dealer. He's not a gun runner. He's not a gangbanger. He had particular kinds of traffic tickets that he was essentially shot and killed for. They're called non-moving violations. I know none of this, by the way. I'm learning this world. He has called non-moving violations. So I call up criminal justice professors, and they say, like, okay, here's what you need to understand. The world of traffic tickets is divided between low-discretionary stops and high-discretionary stops. What's a low-discretionary stop? You go 90 miles an hour in a residential area. What's a high-discretionary stop? You think the guy might not be wearing a seatbelt, you know. Or you think they might be a badass and you stop them and you need to come up with a reason. So you cite them for not wearing a seatbelt. And that's essentially what they're doing for Timothy Thomas. So we had a lot of these high discretionary stops. That's interesting. Okay, so what do we know about high discretionary stops? Is Timothy Thomas a one-off? So I filed open records requests with the city of Cincinnati, who did it for some other cities in Ohio. Is Timothy Thomas alone or not? It turns out that whites and blacks in Cincinnati get ticketed for moving violations at about the same rate, no matter how you figure out the denominator. But when it comes to non-moving violations, the kind of violations that Timothy Thomas was killed for, you get those, blacks get those at about 3 times the rate as whites in the city of Cincinnati. That's great. This work took me about 2 weeks. I go to Neil's office and he goes, "That's great. Do the country." Okay. So we start filing open records requests at that point in every city in the country that kept this kind of information. And what we found is that almost every city in the country had this kind of pattern. We did find a couple exceptions. And the heads of police departments there said, "Yeah, we understand this kind of policing goes on. We don't do it. We believe it's a waste of time. In fact, you can go check it out." So in police world, again, I'm learning things like going on, there's something called the hit rate. If you pull someone over for a high discretionary stop and you think they have guns and drugs, you're going to search them. It takes about 40 minutes, an hour, maybe longer. And when you search them, if you find guns and drugs, that's the hit rate. How often do you find it? Turns out that in the cities with these disproportional pulling over blacks, their hit rates are awful for finding guns and drugs on blacks. They find it far more often on whites. That's fascinating. No one had ever done this before. So I'm doing this kind of work. We ended up telling an hour-long documentary on NBC. It was the most watched thing in America that night. People do have an appetite for this kind of journalism. It's one of the things that keeps me going. And it did change certain police practices in certain jurisdictions in the country. I found myself a dozen or so years later at the New York Times. After Ferguson, we were asked to do some stories. And I kind of revisited this turf. I was calling a professor at John Jay University, Criminal Justice College in New York. And he said... And I said, "Well, what's the best work out there? How can I really learn about this?" And he said, "Well, you know, if you really want to see the best work that was ever done on this, there was this great documentary done about a dozen years ago at NBC. You really should go check it out."
Oh, my God. That's great.
I learned a lot from people like Timothy Thomas, people I never even met or people I do meet in the course of reporting. So I want to give a shout out to them.
How stupid do I now feel about Ashby and his aquarium trip?
We have a student question for Tali. What does abrupt climate change teach the rest of us about how to be remarkable? Can we solve the environmental crisis if we don't find environmentally remarkable in each other?
Sorry, can you read the first part of the question again?
What does abrupt climate change teach the rest of us about how to be remarkable?
That's a good question. So, my feeling, climate change is inevitable. It's here. It's speeding up. It's violent. That's what climate change to me is violence on corporeal bodies, on ecological bodies, particularly on those who are most marginalized, so women, people of color, people living in island nations, those who have fewer economic resources. So then the question for me is, well, how do we exist, or as the student put it, be remarkable within that context? I wish I had a nice, clean answer, because I think that would make me feel much better about the world. But the two tacks that I take right now are, first, to actually acknowledge where we are and what our limitations are when it comes to change, and that we actually kind of need to go through a grieving process, I think, when it comes to climate change. That acknowledging and spending time with the things that we're losing, or the things that we've lost, or the things we know we're going to lose, the places, the ways of living, that it's important to grieve, and that grieving is actually a lead-in to action or a lead-in to a certain kind of care. That, you know, when we really reflect on what this loss means, that we maybe have more of an impetus to care. And then I also think we have to think about how do we take care of each other, how do we take care of those who are most marginalized within the context of climate change. That means a lot of different things.
It's your good question.
Okay, we have several questions from students and otherwise that group under how you access remarkable people and learn from them. I'm thinking of Jen at NBC sounds well. Yeah, some great bosses. But others ask, can you share some wisdom on seeking out good and lasting mentorship, professionally or otherwise?
For mentorship, I mean, I've tried to talk about Brandt. He really is the person I consider as my mentor. And that's why I mentioned it. By the way, I don't think I was about 30 years old when I met Brandt. So I was at that point in my career where I feel like I hear about mentors. I've never had one, kind of out there on my own. So find people, reach out to them. You'll find a lot of people further down the road in whatever walk of life you're interested in are more than happy to spend time to talk with students, to pay it forward, to talk with the next generation. We all understand that, you know, there is the next generation. We want to pay it forward. But also your friends and family. I mean, I can't begin to describe the importance that I get from friends and family. And, you know, my wife, who, if I could just tell a quick story, you know, sometimes I get asked to, like, when I was at the Times, to go through the Snowden files or go through the WikiLeaks trove of diplomatic cables. And we're brought into this tiny room in the editor's office and we're said, okay, here's the secret trove. You cannot tell anyone you're looking at it. You have to find the stories. We don't know what they are. And if it goes bad, you might be violating national security law and you could be jailed. So you cannot tell your colleagues at your desks what you're doing. And I cannot tell my wife what I'm doing, let alone my kids. So I have to say to them, I'm kind of disappearing for a few weeks or a few months. Just have faith that I'll come back. And, you know, to have that kind of, you know, to have them behind your back is just huge.
My problem with mentorship is that I was completely unaware of it at the time. The only advice I have, and it's only for when you're already in the field, it's not for when you're, you know, a sophomore in college and say, you know, gee, I'd like to call up the governor of my state and, you know, have him be my mentor. But when you're working, just be really good at it. And they need you, and then they mentor you. Or be really good at it except one thing that you know you're stupid about and go to the person who knows it and say, I'm sorry to take up your time, but I'm a producer and I love your stuff and I can't, the thing I can't do is this. And that kind of specificity makes it, because otherwise you're just showing up and saying, hi, can you be my mentor? Which sort of sounds to somebody like, can you get me jobs? Can you hold my hand all the time? Can you... And a horrible thing, students out there, I've been very tended all my life. I had the extraordinary mother and a pretty nice father. I was sent to private schools who were all focused on what's great for Anne. I went to, you know, there was a college counselor who said, what college would be great for Anne? I had academic advisors in college who said, you know what, courses would be great for Anne. And I got out into the world, and there was nobody saying, what would be great for Anne? And Anne started answering phones in the head of the art department at CBS, who was in charge of advertising. And he was not saying, is Anne really set for this career? The ugly truth is once you get out there, they are not your friends. They are not your family. They are not thinking what's great for Anne. You have to sort of decide
You know, and a mentor is not going to be spend their day saying, well, that's great for Anne. You have to do something useful for them. You have to be needed. And being needed means being useful, being smart, showing up. Brief story, my husband's little brother is kind of the last of the four kids and kind of had an uneven path. He decided, he was in college, decided it wasn't for him, dropped out, didn't know what to do. Anyway, he ended up getting a job in a parking garage in Washington, D.C. And, you know, being a nice guy, he showed up and he did his work. And about a week and a half into this job, the owner came by and he said, Hayes, I want you to be the manager of this parking garage. And Hayes said, I've only been here a week and a half. And the manager said, yes, but you show up on time and you don't steal the money. So what we have taught our kids is show up on time, don't steal the money, be useful.
I think the first part of the question was about accessing remarkable people. So I just wanted to say, what if we just thought that everybody around us was remarkable in some way? And that there's something to learn from everyone that you encounter. I try to remember that myself. And in terms of mentorship, I mean, I think that the relationships that I've been lucky to have or develop have come from me trying to work hard at something I was passionate about, and that people have seen that enthusiasm, and then they want to support me. I think those are probably the most fruitful mentorship relationships that have come about.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just a personal note, my experience has been, like speaking to the members on the panel, that most of the people I think of as remarkable or don't see themselves that way. And so you may feel a little standoffish, you're scared to approach them, but I tell my students when I'm teaching, don't. Certainly people who come to CWA are here because they want to interact with you. And one more, I recently had a former student just call me out, who's stably employed out of the blue, and ask me if I would be a professional mentor to her. As a woman and engineer, these kinds of relationships are often important. And I kind of felt, guess I'm still looking for people to mentor me and tell me what I should do. But she reached out to me in a way few people do, and so now she has my ear and whatever, hopefully, you know, guidance or advice I can provide to her once a month. So do reach out. See some students in here. I think we have time for a couple more questions. Let me see. Here's one that's come up in a couple different ways. How do you think our view of remarkable people has changed with the influence of social media?
I got no idea.
We don't know.
Another thing that's important is to admit when you don't know.
I don't. That's a good lesson learned. Okay, another question. We don't know.
That was a different panel.
I have difficulty being calm when I'm passionate about an injustice. How do you stay calm when you feel impatient and passionate in modern day?
Ashy on the stoop, it was an honest mistake, Mommy. You have to be kind, and you have to realize that everybody is in the same boat. These people are not much different from you. They are acting. You can't be frantic around people who are frantic. If they are frantic, you try and figure out what's driving them. It's always some lovely human emotion. If you've got that, you know, frantic, I'm not calm now, everybody out there feels the same stuff, and you can rein it in a little bit by thinking, I bet you other people have had this feeling when they've been frantic, so I don't need to be perfect for other people because they're as imperfect as I am. And you just take a breath and be yourself, and if you're a little frantic about a cause, that's energy, people see it. You know, I just think people get too wrapped up in how people perceive them. And there's a lot more commonality than you think. You're not being judged every second the way you think you're being judged. People have got their own stuff, and they're kind of not watching you as closely as you think they are.
This might be like the artist's answer, but I mean, I feel like be angry and be sad about social injustice. I don't feel very calm about it most of the time, although I certainly think that making and working in my studio and being in conversation in a community with other people who have similar concerns is very helpful. And the other thing I'll say in terms of being angry about social injustice is just to think about where you're directing that anger. And this goes back a little bit to the question right before that we didn't answer. It's less about social media and more about just like the current state of things in this country, that everything feels so bifurcated. If we can't talk to each other. And some of what I think would be helpful is that if instead of directing our anger towards the people that we see every day, if we could look to who's in power and who's controlling the structures and systems, and point our anger in that direction instead of at each other, maybe that would help.
I was just looking at the question. I just said, you know, I would not conflate being passionate with being impatient. I mean, being passionate is like, look, these are the skills that I've developed. This is what I have. If I'm passionate about a subject or I'm curious about something, I have my skills as a journalist. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm impatient. I have to get the story and I have to get it right. And that can take time. Unfortunately, even when editors are asking for that story now, and you're saying, I need a little bit more time. But the passion that I have is trying to find stories that I think are important, that have gone untold, that I think are important for people to realize. So, you know, when we went to go and investigate the global medical device industry the last year, it took us a year. We were very passionate. Our passionate was curiosity, journalistic curiosity. It was also because we're talking about people getting harmed and killed. And we wanted to tell that story, but we could not be impatient. We had to get the story right. You get the story wrong, and it doesn't matter how passionate you are. So I would try to separate those two words.
We just have a few minutes left, but this seems like a good closing question. Given the need of these successful panelists to meet deadlines and exercise leadership in your jobs, how do you maintain the humility necessary to learn from others?
That's easy. Basic insecurity. I don't know anybody who feels like I'm at the top of my game and I can tell. Nobody. Nobody. Everybody's thinking, you know, I have screwed up and I've got to save this. Oh my God, look, I didn't white balance on that shot. How am I going to get around that? There is no perfect product. There is no omnipotent producer. I look back at things I produced and I think, oh, well, I could have done that better. You just have to forgive yourself a little bit and realize that nobody is feeling, I don't think, you know, maybe I'm wrong. And all of you feel absolutely secure and at the top of your game. I never do. Ever. Maybe I'm just, yeah, I need a therapist.
Hallie or Andrew, either of you?
You know, you still, you were... First off, I would agree with everything you said, everything all the panelists have said. You know, I still have to go home and, you know, clean up the dog poop on the floor. You know, I still have to go, you know, I'm with my kids. I try not to miss anything that my kids are involved with. You know, we're just average people. I don't think of myself as accomplished. It's just like, this is what I do. And I go and do it, but I also go and be with my kids. And yes, I was involved in, my son wanted to be a Boy Scout. I do not like the Boy Scouts. But there are people running around in short pants and shirts. So I became an assistant scoutmaster. My son was, you know, you do all this stuff. You do all this stuff, right? You're just with your family. You're with your friends. You know, a friend of mine calls up and says, I'd like to talk. I'm there. You know, I just feel like an average person. I don't feel anything remarkable.
Yeah. I've gotten to work with remarkable people, I think, who probably feel just as insecure as I do. And I understand that from the outside, some of it looks remarkable. I know you're envious that I spoke to Audrey Hepburn, but I'm envious that I spoke to Audrey Hepburn. I mean, you go into all these things and think, am I really here? Are they letting me do this? Are they okay? But everybody is remarkable. My very best friend, Ginger, who has been my best friend since I was 4, she quit her job as a psychologist and was a mom for like 30 years. And she's right now in nursing school because her mom died of ovarian cancer, which was awful. And she so admired the hospice nurses that she wants to be a hospice nurse. The next youngest person in her program is 28. Ginger is one of the most remarkable people I know. I've never met anybody funnier or kinder or more loving. She is on the top of my charts for remarkable. I probably should have put Ginger down here too. But
you just did?
Yeah, just did. Hey, Ginger. I'm not going to say something hallmark like everyone is remarkable in their own way. Because they're not. There's some people who are totally ordinary. But you can be real. But you can look for, you can find a whole lot of remarkable people. I did an hour on hope and optimism. I'll be quick. And we were looking for things that illustrated this. I live in Manhattan. I walk to work, and I walked every morning past. There's a free newspaper that. It was started as a homeless newspaper that people would write articles and then they'd hire homeless people to, you know, give them a job, to hand them out. It's a free newspaper. It has progressed beyond the homelessness, so I don't think the guy was homeless. But there was a guy who I passed every day who had the papers, and you have to kind of, you know, force them into people's hands because we've got the New York Times. We don't need this little 8-page paper. And he'd say, good morning, it's great to see you. You're here all the time. Take a paper. Hey, how are you? I love this shirt. Here, take a paper. And I finally, after a while, asked him what his name was, and it's Oscar. And people were like bringing him Christmas cookies at Christmas time. Oscar was the most positive force in my morning. You know, Oscar was always up. And I ended up putting him into the hour, because if you can have hope and optimism, this was Oscar's third job. He lived in distant Bronx, and he had a job early, I can't remember what doing, and then this was his second job, and then his third job was like in Brooklyn, and he was on the subway half the time, and he was piecing it together, and he was the bright light of my morning. So he was remarkable. He's never going to change the world. He's giving out papers, but he changed my life every day. So look for the remarkable people. You can find them.
Go ahead.
So just a quick answer, and I also feel very ordinary and not remarkable, but I know I'm also surrounded by artist colleagues most of the time who I admire incredibly and think are remarkable peers who also think of themselves as fairly ordinary. But I think, you know, a big part of that is that you have to just keep working. There's always more work to do. And you don't become remarkable or successful or have one success and then just coast. Like, I think, you know, in order, you have to keep going. You're no longer remarkable, I guess, if you're not working.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to wind up with just one tip I see actually a few of my students in class. One of the ways to access remarkable people, of course, is to come to events like CWA. We have a few more panels today, a little pitch for that. But last year, one of my students told me she was during CWA having lunch with one of the speakers who was prominent in our field of global international development. Just having lunch with this person who I even are kind of intimidated around. But she found out he was here and looked at the program and looked at people's backgrounds and thought, I'd really like to get to know this person. You know, I want to find out more about working at their agency. And she emailed him, which we're kind of told not to do, not to email you guys. So I'm not saying you're supposed, I'm just telling you what someone did. Had lunch with this professional person a year ago and is still, I would say, being mentored by him and in contact. So remarkable people, as I said, often don't think they're remarkable. And certainly if they're at CWA, they're here to reach out to you and be interacting with you. So don't be shy about talking to them. These folks may be here for a few minutes, for instance, when we wrap up this conference today. So thank you for coming, and hope you get some more sessions on the last.